Well, we had just talked about Williams and Clark creating a colony where all men could worship as they please, and there are many Baptist churches in the colony. Many religious groups were represented in the colony. One historian wrote, "Notwithstanding so many differences, here are fewer quarrels about religion than elsewhere, the people living peaceably with their neighbors of whatever profession. Despite the persecutions awaiting them, the Baptists continued to increase in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Welsh Baptists moved to the New World and began Welsh-speaking Baptist churches in both Massachusetts and Rhode Island." This is a very common thing in American history. Groups come in, they start a church in their language, but over a period of time, their children grow up without that language and they change. You know, Ravenswood was German-speaking. Okay? This is a very normal experience. Still happening. I mean, there's churches in Tagalog and just all kinds of languages all over the place. A Baptist church was begun in Boston in the home of their pastor, Thomas Gould. Thomas Gould, G-O-U-L-D. And persecution soon came. Various people were imprisoned for sympathizing with the Baptists, including the mother of David Yale, the founder of Yale University. Mother of David Yale. Probably to this day, Harvard and Yale are considered the most prestigious colleges in the United States. So here's another trivia question for you. Why was David Yale, founder of Yale University's mother, why did she spend time in prison? For supporting Baptists. The Puritans were unrelenting in their persecution of Baptist, Quakers, and other nonconformists. This was the time of the famous witchcraft trials. Various individuals in Salem were accused and punished as witches without there being any real evidence against them. Okay. If you read this story of the Salem witchcraft trials, I have a suspicion the first person they executed was actually a witch. But after that, what would happen would be wild accusations could be made against anybody, and evidence was not much of an issue. Okay. Baptists opposed the witchcraft trials. Say, believe in a mouth of two or three witnesses, a thing is established. Robert Califf, C-A-L-I-F, Robert Califf, the pastor of the Baptist Church in Boston, wrote a book against the foolishness of the trials. Against the foolishness of the trials. And the Puritans accused the Baptists of being defenders of the devil. Defenders of the devil. Couldn't you see that coming? When a Baptist preacher stood up and said, "Wait a minute, what's the evidence against these people?" Couldn't you see what was coming after that? They get accused of defending the devil, defending witches, defending the occult. Count on this, if you're going to be in a ministry, you are often going to be utterly amazed at the accusations made against you. One important Puritan leader repented of persecuting the Baptists and openly spoke out for religious freedom. Cotton Mather, once a vicious persecutor, preached the ordination sermon for Baptists in 1717. And in his sermon, he says the persecution of the Baptists had been a terrible mistake. Unfortunately, very few Puritans agreed with him. William Penn, whose father was a Baptist, founded the colony of Pennsylvania. Penn, a Quaker, was a supporter of religious liberty. Supporter of religious liberty. And soon men of all religious persuasions flocked to the new colony. One of my favorite William Penn stories, by the way. As a Quaker, they did not believe in, normally in the presence of people, you would take off your hat as it was considered a sign of respect. And the higher ranking person in the room was the only one who could wear a hat. And the Quakers believed that all men were equal. So one of the rules in the English crown was that no one could wear their hat in front of the king. And William Penn's going in to see King James II. People wondered what's going to happen because his Quaker faith tells him he can't take his hat Is James going to ignore it? Is he going to have him arrested? Is he going to fine him? What's going to happen? So he walks in front of the king, doesn't take his hat off. King James II smiles and says the law forbids more than one hat to be worn in the presence of the king. So he takes off his own hat. And William Penn's the only man in the room with a hat on. Penn, a Quaker, was a supporter of religious liberty. And I don't think I mentioned it there, but the King James II had borrowed huge amounts of money from the Penn family. He didn't have the money to repay it. So this was the deal. James gave him the right to this huge tract of land in the New World in exchange for the forgiveness of his debt, which was a deal, because James had never been to the New World and done anything with it or whatever, but he gave him, Pennsylvania's a big state. He gave him Pennsylvania in exchange for the forgiveness of the debt. When he gave him something he owned in name only and had never been to and wasn't doing anything with in exchange for large debt, which was a deal for him. But this was Penn's motive in having a colony. He wanted a colony where everybody could be free. Baptists from, he was supportive of religious liberty. Soon men of all religious persuasions flocked to the new colony. Baptists from England, Wales, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island soon moved to Pennsylvania and began churches there. By the way, you know the Pennsylvania settlers were never attacked by Indians even once? And there were two reasons. They bought the land, and secondly, they were pacifists. They would not fight. And the Indians respected them and never attacked them, even to the point when Indian tribes were having wars with one another and they wanted to have a peace council, they would go to Pennsylvania because they felt Pennsylvania was the place they would not be attacked. And so warring Indian groups would send delegations to Pennsylvania to discuss making peace. And while the Pennsylvania settlers were armed, they used for hunting. Indians never attacked them. And it was an amazing thing. Okay. Well, Baptists from England, Wales, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island soon moved to Pennsylvania to make churches there. A group of Pennsylvania Quakers became convinced of believers' baptism and became known as Quaker Baptists. Daniel Boone was actually born into a Quaker Baptist family, but later lost his church membership because he was not a pacifist. A group of Pennsylvania Quakers became convinced of believers' baptism, became known as Quaker Baptists. Daniel Boone remained a Baptist, however, and his brother Squire had the distinction of starting the First Baptist Church in Kentucky and then later the First Baptist Church in Indiana during the exploring years. A group of Germans became convinced of believers' baptism and settled in New York and Pennsylvania. They were known as Dunkers. Okay. You can guess where they got that name from, or German Baptists. Y'all be kind. Ravenswood was started as a German Baptist church. And near the Indian Village Baptist Church that I was telling you about, near that site, there's an old building that 10 years ago was ready to collapse. It may still may be gone by now, but it had the name Dunker Baptist on it. This old building. It's right by the river, and I'm assuming the river was their baptistry. That's the name on a building, Dunker Baptist. Sort of redundant. Yeah. Either word would have given me the idea, but just in case you had any questions. Excuse me. Many Baptists also settled in the colony of New Jersey. They included Baptists from England, Holland, and Germany. Obadiah Holmes moved to New Jersey and pastored a Baptist church there. William Screven, S.C., William Screven, S.C., R-E-V-E-N, helped organize the First Baptist Church in Maine. But persecution forced him and the other Maine Baptists to South Carolina. That's a big jump. They picked up as a church and moved as a whole. The early rulers of South Carolina determined to establish the Church of England by force, but continually met with resistance. from the early settlers and won an established church. Later governors were sympathetic to religious freedom. One was rumored to secretly be a Baptist, and they hesitated to enforce the concept of an established church. Why would somebody secretly be a Baptist in that setting? He probably needed a lot of Church of England votes to get elected governor. There were a few Baptists in the southern colonies before the General Awakening, before the Great Awakening, I'm sorry. There were a few Baptists in the southern colonies before the Great Awakening. However, some General Baptists had moved into Virginia. Baptist congregations were rare. Later, Baptists from Maryland and Wales moved into Virginia in great numbers. Baptist churches in Philadelphia organized the Philadelphia Baptist Association. Philadelphia Baptist Association. That provided them a basis for cooperation in several projects. The idea of a voluntary association, not a denomination, but a voluntary association you could join and leave anytime you wanted for the purpose of doing some things together. The idea of a voluntary association became very popular. It was a common vehicle for Baptist churches to use in carrying out joint projects. What do you think is the danger of a voluntary association? I'm not against them. I actually belong to one. But what's the danger? Well, that could be, though that hasn't been seen so much through voluntary associations. In a denomination, they order you what to do. In a convention, you're sort of bound to go with the group that you can leave. In a voluntary association, you can come and go as you please. So what's the danger? And I'm not against them. I don't believe they're scriptural, but there is still a danger. Well, yes, there is that, but there's also this. It becomes a psychological thing. This is our group. I've got to help our group. I've got to stand with our group. And while there's nobody to order you to do it, you feel this psychological pressure, and if you've gotten the people of your church too involved in it, they feel like this is what they have to do. So, I'm not against voluntary associations. You've seen some of them, like the Philadelphia Baptist Association, accomplish some great things. I belong to one. Obviously, I'm not against them. But you always have to be careful of the danger of being too tied in. That you feel maybe not a legal pressure, but a psychological pressure to do something you don't think you should do. And I feel the same way, Bible colleges, camps, anything. You shouldn't be so wrapped up in one that you have to go the direction it goes. No matter what. I love some of the institutions I have a chance to be somewhat associated with. But I decided a long time ago I would never have just one Bible college. Or I would ever be attached to some youth camp. Or tied to a speaker so much that I have to go the direction they go. And I think that's important. We can lose our independence in practice without losing it under the letter of the law. And so I've chosen to be very careful about that. Okay. Well, most colonial governments treated Baptists with hostility or outright persecution. Hostility or outright persecution. Only in Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. Temporarily. New York, New Jersey, and Maryland. Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, did they find the religious freedom and separation of church and state that was so important to them. In some colonies, the persecution became as great as it had been in England. When I say that, I don't mean as great as it had been in English history hundreds of years back, but as great as it had been in England when they left it. Again, there's not a record of anybody in the colonies ever being executed for being a Baptist. Normally, you were fined. Sometimes you were beaten. Sometimes you were jailed. And those things are not religious freedom. You do recover from them in a fashion you don't recover from death. Usually, if you're burned at the stake, it's the last time. If you're beaten, you may live to preach and be beaten again. So there was persecution, but it doesn't compare to the persecution of the past. Some New England Baptists formed the Warren Association, which is another of my favorite stories. Some New England Baptists formed the Warren Association, headquartered in Warren, Rhode Island, to campaign for religious freedom in the colonies. The Warren Association appointed Isaac Bacchus as its spokesman. He traveled throughout the colonies campaigning for religious freedom and organizing aid for churches in trouble. Now, this is it's an amazing thing. He's pastor of the same Baptist church for 60 years while traveling all over the colonies campaigning for religious freedom. The church got a vision of this. They saw it as their ministry, and so they support it. And some churches don't like the idea of their pastor having what they call an outside ministry. But they saw this as their ministry, fighting for religious freedom. He pastors the same church for 60 years, even though at times he'll go away for weeks to be part of this battle or that battle. And that's a tremendous testimony to that church. Now, he led the battle against paying taxes for the support of established churches. State licensure of preachers. And of limitations upon publishing religious literature. Where there was a battle because the church was exercising its liberty, he would go there and aid the church in that battle. So he had battles. Preachers wouldn't take a license. A lot of times preachers wouldn't take a license and the community didn't really notice them or chose not to notice them. But sometimes that wasn't the case and a preacher was on trial. So forth. He participated in those kind of things as a help to folks. Now, while carrying out this work, Bacchus continued as the pastor of the same Baptist church for 60 years. When I was pastoring in Indiana, I would go down to Franklin College, long a modernist Baptist college. But they had a rare book room. And they would allow pastors to get into the rare book room. And in the rare book room were a number of Isaac Bacchus's books. You couldn't take them out, but I could go sit there and read them. And I read some of them, and they're not in print today. I think he had one book on separation of church and state that's still in print today, but he wrote many things on the subject. I'd sit there and read the books by Isaac Bacchus and the understanding of separation of church and state and the dedication to the separation of church and state. And thank God for men like that. You and I enjoy freedoms today because of men like that. Thank God for a church that would support their pastor in such a ministry. Because you and I are benefiting from that today. Baptists in Virginia found themselves in considerable conflict with the Church of England that was established by the colonial government. They were ordered to get licenses from the state. But most refused. They were ordered to get licenses from the state or close. Baptists were ordered to pay taxes to the state church, but most refused. They were ordered to get licenses from the state or close their ministries, but most refused. And when I was in Florida, I had not been there but a few months, when the state of Florida passed a law that made Bible colleges as we know them illegal. And what I mean by that is you had to register from the state, get a license, and they would tell you what your curriculum had to be, and you had to have, you could only have 25% of your curriculum be religious. And they didn't count English class as religious or history class, but can you imagine what happens to the curriculum of the normal Bible college when only 25% of it can be Bible and practical theology? And And ironically enough, the law was authored by the man who had previously been the president of the college I had just become president of, which was a tremendous irritation. We were members of the same church. And they sent out all the paperwork and the forms, and I went to the pastor and said, look, I can't sign all this. I can't do this. And he said, you know you could end up in jail. And I said, I'm aware of that, but I can't do this. So he agreed to back me, and we refused to get the license, pay the form, pay the fee. And I went to a meeting where they were explaining the new law and what you had to do. I went to the meeting, and I said, what are you going to do? I'm asking a member of the same church I'm a member of. What are you going to do if some Baptist preacher says, I cannot do this, and refuses? I said, will you testify against them in court? This preacher and an attorney. And he said, well, I have to. It's the law. I said, you do understand, Baptists have been resisting what they considered invasions of separation church and state. They've been resisting such laws for centuries. And they've gone, they've been thrown to wild animals, burned at the stake, had their heads cut off, drowned. I said, this is not a new thing for us. I said, what are you going to do? He said, well, I have to pray about it. I said, I don't. Because I said, the first time you go after a Baptist preacher with this law, I'm going to stand with him. I don't have to pray about that. Well, a few weeks later, they found a Bible college with 12 students that wasn't cooperating. Couldn't find us. We had a 10-story building. They couldn't find us. They couldn't find Pensacola Christian College, which at that time was not cooperating, and it's 6,000 students. But they found a school with 12 students. And they wrote them a letter, told them to either apply or to cease and desist. They said they're not going to. They wrote them a letter to cease and desist from operation. But the guy didn't. I did not know him. I went down to see him. He was actually angry because he assumed I was with the guy that wrote the law, because we were members of the same church. I had to force my way into his office and said, are you going to fight this? He said, yes. I said, well, I'm going to fight it with you, whether you want me or not. But we became good friends. And I was talking to somebody in the Department of Education. I said, what are you going to do? The ball's in your court. You sent him a letter to cease and desist, and he's not. And they said, well, he has to. We sent him a letter. I said, Baptists have been burned at the stake over this issue. They've been beheaded. They've been thrown to the wild animals. They've been shot by firing squads. They've been burned at the stake. They've been drowned. Do you really think a Baptist trembles because he got a letter? And I said, y'all need to think, figure out what you're going to do, because you've sent him a letter and you've told him to stop. He isn't. So what are you going to do? I said, you're going to ask the county police to arrest him? The police of the city he's in to arrest him? The state police to go arrest him? So you better figure out what you're going to do. And say, when do you got figured out? I said, if you get him, I'm going to go run his college. And then you're going to have to come arrest me, because I'm not going to stop. And I said, and once you've arrested me, we've got 5 other men signed up to take over. And once you've arrested them, I said, by the time you get to going on this, I'll bet we'll have a bunch more. At the time, it was the year that Jeb Bush was running for re-election. And I said, normally the Republicans think of us as their allies. So you might want to ask yourself the question, how many of his natural allies does Jeb Bush want to put in jail during election year? Because I said, I will make sure everybody in the state knows this, that it's Jeb Bush's administration putting these Baptist preachers in jail. They never moved. It sat for years. And then the Commission on Independent Colleges, which was the government entity that controlled this, elected, or the governor appointed a new commissioner. He got reelected, appointed a new commissioner. And he was a man that lived in Haines City, Florida, where the college was and where I lived. My house was 3 blocks from his office. And I knew him because the college had bought 5 buildings from the First Presbyterian Church, and he was a member of First Presbyterian Church, and he and I did the negotiating of the real estate contract. Very detailed man. We spent many hours together figuring out every little detail. So I called him and said, congratulations on your appointment to this commission. I said, I don't know if anybody bothered to tell you this or not, but we've been in defiance of your commission for about 3 years. And I thought it'd be good if we sat down and talked. He came over to the college, and we sat down, and I explained to him our position. He said, can you prove that from the Bible? So I showed him some scripture passages, and he said, well, I'm a Christian before I'm anything else. He said, I'm a Christian before I'm a Presbyterian. I'm a Christian before I'm a politician. I'm a Christian before I'm the chairman of the commission. And he says, I believe in obeying the Bible no matter what it conflicts with. And he says, as long as I'm chairman of the commission, this law won't be enforced. And he said, I will help you try to change it. Wow, we weren't expecting that. And we did. I wrote a new law, got CLA. CLA's looking over my shoulder while I'm writing it, but I wrote the law. And we start campaigning for it in the state legislature to get this law. And experiences I will never forget and how God worked. We're going to meetings and we're explaining these things to people. And there's a guy there who's a paid lobbyist, $500 an hour for trade schools. And he hears us, not even saved. He comes in and he says, this law is ridiculous. Why does the state want to bother Bible colleges? He goes, I'll help you with this. And at his own time, on his own time, not asking for a penny, he would go with us, professional lobbyist, and get us in the offices of legislators. And then when we're getting close to the bill being voted on, and we put on a big push, and we got Pastor Carter, who I work for, up, and some other preachers up. It's hard to get in these offices. The paid lobbyists know how to do this. And he's getting us in offices, but there's like five or six of us, and we're only getting to one guy at a time because he's getting us in the doors. We're walking down the hallway. Somebody says, Pastor Carter, what are you doing here? It was a graduate of the church's high school who years ago had graduated from high school, got a job as a full-time legislator, moved to Tallahassee. And so Pastor Carter told him, and he flips out his cell phone, calls his boss, and can I have the day off? And he starts going with us. We're now divided into two groups that each have professional edges. We're going talking to these people, and we get to the state representative from Pensacola. Pensacola had told us they would fight for this if it ever had a chance of success, but they didn't believe it had any chance of success. So while I'm in the room, the legislator from Pensacola calls Pensacola Christian College, says, what do you think about this? And they ask him, does this have a chance of passing? He said, it's about 50-50. The next day, Pensacola had lobbyists all over Tallahassee campaigning for it. I was really irritated when they wouldn't support it at first, but they did keep their word. They said, if it has a chance of passing, we'll put everything we got by. And I mean, there were lobbyists everywhere. Long story short, we won by a 2/3 vote. And the law in the state of Florida would read, if your college had a religious name and a religious purpose and you didn't take any money from the state, you were exempt from control by the state. I wrote it. I was perfectly happy with that. And there was a notation they added to put in there that this does not prevent anybody from suing you for fraud if you don't tell them the truth about your school. But religious name, religious purpose, Landmark Baptist College for training preachers, teachers, missionaries, Christian school teachers, no money from the state, you're not under the state's jurisdiction. That's called separation of church and state. And when you're under the state's jurisdiction, that is not called separation of church and state. And I remember talking with one of the education officials during the process of this, and I was getting frustrated. I just looked at him and said, you're the state. We're the church. We're separate. What part of this do you not understand? And that was the law for 14 years in the state of Florida. It just got struck down last year and going to have to be fought all over again. And that is one of the lessons of all these. Legal and legislative victories are never permanent. They're always temporary. They always have to be refought. I hope the men down there will refight it. I'll tell you one more thing. I believe in a lot of details. It was a story I lived for 5 years. After this is over, Department of Education calls me. I said, Dr. Stringer, we're sorry for all the confusion that was over all this. We never meant to step on the church's, any church's liberty. And we have an open position on the council that regulates independent colleges. and said, we can't put you on it because you're from Haines City and the chairman's from Haines City, and that would be two people from the same small town. But said, could you recommend somebody to us to serve on that commission that would let all the churches know that they don't have anything to be concerned about? I said, sure. You remember the guy you gave the cease and desist order to and threatened to arrest? Put him on a commission, and everybody will know that you're serious. So they did. I went to his installation. Here's the first thing he said as a member of the commission. He said, we should open and close these meetings with prayer. And so they started doing that. And he served 2 7-year terms, and the law was safe as long as he was there. As soon as he was gone, he had a different situation. But as long as he was there, the law was safe. Nobody even tried to introduce anything because it was never going to get past him. And I'll never forget those moments. And I actually got to know a lot of the people who worked for the commission, and they became friends. And when they found out I was moving to Chicago, they asked me to come up and be at the next commission meeting. And we had refreshments and so forth afterwards, and they all came up and wished me well. And one even came up and hugged me. And I said, you know, I've been threatened by bureaucrats, attacked by bureaucrats, insulted by bureaucrats. I had never been hugged by a bureaucrat before, ever. But it was a great moment. In my mind, what I was doing there was exactly what Isaac Bacchus did for 60 years. There is not much sense of fighting these battles today, but there ought to be, and we're going to regret that we don't. I didn't believe we should be licensed, and we weren't. Forgive me if I'm repeating myself. When I came to Chicago, our Christian school was licensed, and it made me uncomfortable. I spent 2 years talking about these things. I preached to our people. I got them ready for a big church-state fight, told them the story of Florida and all that. A year fight that could take years and so forth. Church voted to turn in our license. Dr. Engel and I wrote up a letter explaining why we were turning in the license, went to the appropriate office in downtown Chicago, went in, handed them the letter, 2 copies of the letter, and a guy read it and said, okay, pulled out a stamp and stamped it approved. We went back with one. That was the whole thing. And I was utterly amazed. But I said, okay, don't want a license, don't have to have one. And that was a much better understanding of things than what I... In fact, I found a much better understanding of things in liberal Chicago than what I had experienced in conservative Florida. And I remember leaving the office, and it was almost an emotional letdown because I was ready for the fight of a lifetime. But we're not licensed. The Great Awakening led to a tremendous increase in the number of Baptists in Virginia. General, regular, and particular Baptist. Eventually, the regular and particular Baptist merged, and a new group that was greatly influenced by the Great Awakening became popular. They were led by Shubal Sturbs, S-H-U-B-A-L. He's a fellow we quoted at the beginning of this lesson. Shubal Sturbs, S-T-E-A-R-N-S, were evangelistic in outlook. I mean, they have a tremendous record of starting churches and so forth. And were quick to oppose the idea of formal Bible training for preachers. They were opposed to any kind of Bible college or formal training. As you can guess, my association with Bible colleges over the years has not made me popular in that group. Today, in the early days, they were great soul winners who really didn't believe in Bible colleges. Today, their basic belief is they don't believe in Bible colleges. Can you guess what most of their churches are like today? 15, 20 people, 30 people, hearing sermons against Bible college every week. Totally untrained men. I preached in a conference with one of them one time. And I preached, and he got up afterwards and preached a message against Bible colleges. At the time, I'm a Bible college president, so everybody's wanting to know after the service how I felt. His message was horrible. He rambled all over the place. He didn't have to tell you nobody ever trained him. And I said I would pay him money to travel around the country and preach that sermon as long as he would agree to say I was not trained by Landmark Baptist College at the end of it. So it would be the greatest advertisement we could have ever had. But that's not what the separate Baptists are. I mean, they did oppose Bible college from the beginning, but that wasn't their theme from the beginning. A marker at the original separate Baptist church at Sandy Creek, North Carolina, and I have been there and seen a marking, reads like this. on this site in November and December 1755. Reverend Shubal Stearns, his wife, and those who came with him, seven of the families, 16 souls in all, built their first meeting house where they administered the Lord's Supper. It is a mother church, nay, a grandmother and a great-grandmother. All the separate Baptists sprang hence not only eastward toward the sea, but westward towards the great river Mississippi, northward to Virginia, and southward to South Virginia and Georgia. The word went far from this Zion, and great was the company of them who published it, so much that her converts were as drops of the morning dew. They started churches all over the place. They were a church-starting machine. Hundreds of them. Again, the movement doesn't stay strong. They were uneducated preacher in a day where there were not many Bible colleges and most preachers were uneducated. And God used them in spite of their lack of education. But when not being educated becomes your theme, what do you think happens? Well, how would you like to go to church every week and hear a sermon against Bible colleges? Would that be worth getting up for in the morning? Okay. Figure that out. Stearns was preaching the gospel. And that was a little side thing. Okay. George Whitfield observed that many of the converts of the Great Awakening were becoming Baptist. He's reported to have said, "My chickens have turned to ducks." And the reason for that were ducks put their heads under the water. No. So, yes, that was the reason. So he said, his chickens have become ducks, their heads have gone under the water. Okay. You never seen ducks do that? That's how they fish. Yeah. Well, he said, his chickens have become ducks, our heads have been under the water. In 1768, three Baptists were arrested for witnessing in Virginia. And they continued to preach through the windows of the Culpeper County Jail. Three Baptists were arrested for witnessing in Virginia, and they continued to preach through the windows of the Culpeper County Jail. This attracted great crowds, and the authorities finally freed their prisoners rather than allow this to continue. This led to a tremendous upsurge in persecution. Baptists were constantly being fined for not attending the state church. Non-Baptists such as Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison came to their defense. Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison came to their defense. What do you think it did to their cause to have such prominent people in the colony of Virginia to side with them? And Henry and Jefferson and Madison were not siding with them because they were Baptists. Jefferson's not even saved. They're siding with them because they believe in liberty. They're pretty serious about this liberty thing. Ask George III if you have any questions. King George III if you have any questions. They're pretty serious about this liberty thing. And they didn't just mean liberty for themselves. The love of liberty that was about to be expressed in the War for Independence was outraged by this example of tyranny from colonial government. Patrick Henry defended Baptists in court. He was a lawyer. Who were accused of preaching without a license. And he did it without cost to the preachers. He's a Presbyterian, but he believed in liberty. And I think I mentioned very early in this class, one of my favorite stories is Patrick Henry coming in while trial's already in progress, and the prosecution has given his case. And he probably came in late on purpose, you know, the dramatic entry. All of a sudden, Patrick Henry walks in the courtroom, walks over, picks up a copy of the indictment. Starts walking around the courtroom, waving the indictment over his head, talking about all the terrible problems the colony of Virginia faced. He said, what are the charges today? You know, you got Indians, you got pirates, you got highway bandits. He said, so what are we dealing with today? Oh, these men are accused of preaching the gospel of the Son of God without a license. Walks around the courtroom again, listing all the problems that Virginia faced that you should be focusing on. And then says, what are these men accused of here today? Preaching the gospel of the Son of God without a license. And he does it a third time. They're walking around the courtroom, waving the indictment, dramatic flair. Patrick Henry, one of the most famous citizens of the state. And then the defense rests. And the jury lets them go. Jury nullification. Jury lets them go. His eloquence and his political influence usually led to acquittals. Not a bad thing having Patrick Henry as your lawyer in Virginia, and you could afford it because he didn't charge when preachers were being prosecuted for preaching without a license. He did not bill you. Great, great friend of freedom. In spite of the fact he went a Baptist and he didn't understand any of the Baptist distinctives. That maybe separates church and state. Jefferson and Madison campaigned for religious liberty in the state legislature. However, Baptists did not have freedom until after the war for independence had been fought and won. Another of my favorite stories here, and we'll probably close with that story today. Baptists played prominent roles in the settlement of Kentucky. The famous explorer and settler Daniel Boone was a Baptist. In later years, he would live in St. Louis, and there was no Baptist church, and he would attend a Presbyterian church every Sunday, and they kept appealing to him to join. He said he would not join anything but a Baptist church. In fact, the entire settlement at Boonesboro appears to have been Baptist. There's some fuss about the details of this, but here's what appears to have happened. A group of people, basically in the same Baptist church in North Carolina, got angry at their taxes, and they went to the tax assessor's office and burnt it to the ground. And then decided that maybe moving was a good idea. And they picked up a few other people along the way, but it was mostly folks from the same church who went with Daniel and Squire Boone into Kentucky to found Boonesboro, wanting to get somewhere far enough away, willing to brave the wilderness because they just wanted to be left alone. And Daniel's brother, Squire, entire settlement of Boonesboro appears to have been Baptist. Squire Boone, Daniel's brother, was an ordained preacher who founded the first Baptist church in Kentucky. And so in Boonesboro, the story of the famous siege of Boonesboro, they have about 60 men inside the fort, about 400 Indians outside the fort. This is during the War for Independence. And the Indians had captured a number of men of the colony who were out getting salt at the salt lick. Boone saw that they were surrounded, that they couldn't survive the battle, so he surrendered everybody. He later gets tried for this, but he surrendered everybody after he got a promise from the Indians they wouldn't kill any of his people. And they didn't. All but three of them eventually get back home. But they take Boone, and the others get sold to the British in Detroit, and they adopt Boone into the Shawnee Indian tribe. And for a period of time, he acts like he's just so happy to be there. And they begin to trust him more and more. He hears the plots. They're planning to go to Boonesboro and take the settlement. And they got to the place where they would allow him to hunt. He's a very good hunter, and he's bringing back food all the time. And they'd allow him to hunt without supervision. So on the next hunt, he takes off. Leaves his rifle and some other things in one place, knowing that will lead them to look in that area, when he takes off another direction. And so he spends the day, night and day, trying to get home. Gets back, organizes the settlers. In a few weeks, the Shawnee Indians show up, and he runs up a British flag. You see, he later gets prosecuted for this too and found innocent. He runs a British flag. You don't need to conquer us. We're on your side. And for a while, they didn't know what to do. And they said, well, we want to come inside. He said, well, we have a smallpox epidemic. And we're afraid of you all getting sick. So they wouldn't let him in because, you know, we don't want our allies, the Shawnee, to get smallpox. So after a while, after several days, they come to the conclusion that they've been had. And a siege starts in earnest. Squire Boone gets a broken leg from a bullet, and he's not in the fighting after the first day. But they get in a tough spot. The Shawnees have them surrounded. They're up in trees firing into the fort. They've dug a tunnel and are about to come under the wall and up in. And they're firing, just like you'd see on a TV program, you know, they're shooting fire arrows into the settlement. And they don't, the walls of the fort are too thick. They don't really, fire arrows don't do much there. But if you can get them in the roofs of the buildings, fire spreads. And they're in a mess. It takes every man to put out the fires. They don't have men to man the walls. Indians are about to charge at the walls while another group is, they're just waiting for the tunnel to come under the walls. And they gather the women and children in a powder magazine with Squire Boone, who's wounded. He's their pastor. And the women, reason the women and children in the powder magazine, Squire Boone has a lighted torch because they're not going to let them be taken as prisoners. So he's going to blow it and all the women and children up if the Shawnee Indians get inside. So they're in there, the mothers are holding their children, and their pastors lead them in prayer, and that'd be a prayer meeting. That'd be a job for a pastor, to blow up all the women and children in your church so that they don't meet a worse fate. They're praying, they're begging for God to do something. And a thunderstorm comes up out of nowhere,